So it's a pleasure to be back here at Santa Barbara, as always. And I'll give a talk which really resulted from the fact that over the last two or three years, I was going around saying that I don't understand what it means that supersymmetry is broken. And it is surprising because it took me a quarter of a century working on the subject to realize that I'm really very confused and I don't understand what it means. So this is the background. So let me start with some introduction. We know that supersymmetry should be broken, and therefore there should be a massless Goldsteiner, but the analog of Goldstones. And if we have gravity, supersymmetry is gauged, and therefore the Goldsteiner is eaten by the Goldsteiner in the Higgs mechanism. However, if supersymmetry is broken at a relatively low scale, then the Goldsteiner is very light, and the coupling of light matter to Goldsteiner are dominated by the coupling to the Goldsteiner. Very much like the coupling of matter to W is dominated by the coupling to the longitudinal W in the limit that G goes to zero. So as G goes to zero, the transverse gauge fields decouple, but the longitudinal mode, which is eaten, which would have been a Goldstone boson if G equals zero, is what gives the dominant coupling. So you can either think of this problem as, what do we know about couplings to light Goldsteiners? Or equivalently, what do we know about coupling to Goldsteiners? And I think the proper way to say is Goldsteiner, but I will not be that careful. So what are the tools that we are going to use? So we want to imitate what's being done for pions. And throughout the talk, I'll have a lot of analogies, and I'll emphasize where it is and where it's not, like pion physics. And there are really two approaches to pion physics. One is based on current algebra. We have a symmetry, we have conserved currents. The conserved currents have commutation relations, and we use that to extract information. And there's a completely equivalent way of doing it, using an effective Lagrangian where the symmetry is non-linearly realized. So what I would like to do here is give you the analog of these two approaches for the problem of Goldsteiners. So this is a problem that could have been addressed in the 70s and early 80s. And in fact, it was addressed in the 70s and early 70s. And in fact, this is where supersymmetry really started. It started in the nonlinear realization. However, the formalism I'll present today will be much more transparent than anything in the literature, and I'll compare with the literature later, and I show where this formalism is better. So what are the questions we would like to answer? As an old person, I said that the best way when you start a project is to know what it is that you're really interested in and stay focused. So the first, we would like to understand what are the interactions of Goldsteiner. What is the most general thing we can write down? In particular, we would like to derive the Akulov-Volkov Lagrangian in a way that, at least when I looked at it the first time, it looked like here are some nonlinear transformations pulled out of thin air. Where did this come from? Not clear. And then you work very, very hard to find the Lagrangian, which is invariant under these transformations. The Volkov-Akulov Lagrangian has three terms. There's a kinetic term for the Goldsteiner, which has two Goldsteiners and one derivative. That's easy. Dirac already knew that. Then there are terms with four fermions and two derivatives, and a term with eight fermions and four derivatives. And then it stops. So this does not look like an expansion in the number of derivatives, because there's not all the terms have the same number of derivatives. And in addition, it stops. So other corrections to this Lagrangian. And in fact, I asked some experts in the field, is this exact or other corrections? What's the analog of high derivative corrections in the pion Lagrangians? And famous people in the field told me it stops. Famous people in the field probably told me probably not. And if not, we could be interested in the question, what are the more general corrections? This is probably of purely academic interest. These corrections will never be measured. But if we would discuss Goldsteiners or supersymmetry breaking, I think we have to understand what it is we are talking about. So this is the first kind of question. The second kind of question is the analog of pionucleon coupling. So we take the Goldstone bosons and we couple them to other fields. And we would like to know how do they couple? First, how do they couple to superfield? So imagine we have the MSSM with all its superfields and its off terms and so forth. And now we bring the Goldstino and ask, how does the Goldstino couple to a squark? Or equivalently, go to lower energy, where all the superpartners are absent. We take just the standard model, nothing else. We throw in the Goldstino and we ask, how do Goldstinos couple to fermions? Is it universal or not? And again, it's good to keep in mind the example of pions. In pion-nucleon coupling, there are two leading order couplings which are equal as far as power counting or number of derivatives. One of them is universal and the other is not. One of them, the universal, comes from the kinetic term. The non-universal term has a coefficient which is denoted by GA. It's a number that we either calculate from QCD or we'll go and measure, but it doesn't just follow from the symmetries. What's the analog of that for Goldstinos? Which couplings are universal and which are not? And we can go to gauge fields and scalars and axioms, or real scalars. So to start, we have to first say what it is. What are the currents in the problem? So this problem was analyzed first by Ferrara and Zumino, and I invented the name the Ferrara-Zumino multiplet, which made Sergio very happy. So the energy momentum tensor T mu nu and S mu alpha together sit in a multiplet. And this multiplet is not one that you read about in Wessenbagger, for example. It's a real superfield with a vector index, and I'll go interchangeably between alpha alpha dot notation and mu. So this is the current, and it satisfies a conservation equation. D bar of the current is D alpha of X, where X is a chiral superfield. Just to connect with things that you know about, the energy momentum tensor is an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. There's a spin 2 and a spin 0 component. But we need both of them for conservation. Similarly, S mu alpha has a spin 3 half and a spin 1 half component, and we need both of them for conservation. In a superconformal theory, the spin 0 component of T and the spin 1 half component of S mu alpha are absent. And correspondingly, in this equation, X vanishes. So in the superconformal theory, X is 0. And then the bottom component of J is a current, which is conserved. And this is a U1R current, which sits in the multiplet. However, if the theory is massive, like the theories we'll be interested in, that's not true. X is non-zero. And X as a chiral superfield includes various things which are zero if the theory is conformal. So the theta square component includes the stress of the energy momentum tensor. Throughout this talk, I suppress factors of 2 and I and root 2 in order not to clutter the equations. The correct coefficients are in the paper. So I'll keep it up to coefficients. Here we see in the imaginary part the divergence of the current. So if the theory is conformal, this is zero, and therefore the current is conserved. This is the U1 current. In the theta component, we see the spin 1 half of S. And again, if theory is conformal, it's zero. And at the bottom component, we see a scalar operator, which nobody emphasized. And this will be the hero of today's talk. This little X. What is it? What does it stand for?
By calling it X, you don't mean it's the space-time coordinate.
Absolutely. That's right. It is a function of the space-time coordinate, which I suppress.
I mean, it itself has nothing to do with space.
That's absolutely correct. This thing is usually called X. And you will soon see later that there are many other things which are called X, which are actually related to it. So it's not a good idea to change this notation. And the lowest component is typically denoted by the lowercase of the superfield.
Clarity, should not be interpreted as a comment on the appropriateness of the notation.
For example, this one does not have a Lorentz index, whereas the space-time coordinate does. They also have different dimensions. And now let's see what can we say when supersymmetry is broken. So far I just talked about the algebra and the currents. When supersymmetry is broken, the supercharge does not exist. Very much like in chiral dynamics, when you have pions, the axial charge doesn't exist because of infrared divergences. Similarly here, there are infrared divergences associated with the massless Goldstino, and therefore the charge does not exist. But these currents do exist. They are local, they don't care about the infrared problems, and therefore this whole multiplet does exist. Furthermore, commutators with the current, with the charge, or anti-commutator with the charge, do exist. When we compute commutators, the infrared tail cancels out, and therefore, even though the charge does not exist, commutators with the charge exist, and therefore, operators exist in linear multiplets of the symmetry algebra. So all the operators in the problem must be in linear multiplets of supersymmetry, even though the states in the Hilbert space are not. Now, if supercommutators with the supercharge exist, we can easily set up superspace. So some of you might say that this is completely obvious and trivial. Many people had not appreciated that before, so I'll emphasize it. Even when supersymmetry is broken, we can use superspace. And superspace, as we will see, really simplifies the description and the analysis. So we can still construct superspace. And in particular, these two gadgets, J, alpha, alpha dot, and X, exist. So even when supersymmetry is broken, we define J and X at short distance, and they exist as operators at long distance. Everything is completely trivial, completely trivial, well understood now. There was some confusion about that in the literature. But I'd like to emphasize, we'll soon get things which are a bit surprising from this reasoning. So everything that will follow from this point on in the talk will be completely general. I don't care if the model that breaks supersymmetry is weakly coupled, strongly coupled, etc. There are models of supersymmetry breaking which are incalculable, very, very complicated. As long as at long distance we emerge with broken supersymmetry, these J and X exist. And therefore, we should be able to write J and X in terms of the light fields. So that's what we will do now. In order to do that, I have to say something about the order parameter for supersymmetry breaking. And here we see a surprise. So let's review what happens for chiral dynamics. In chiral dynamics, there are two objects which should not be confused with one another. One of them is the order parameter psi bar psi. It gets a wave and it breaks supersymmetry. And if we put gamma 5 or if we work two component notation, it is also a good interpolating field for the pion. This is not to be confused with f pi. F pi is a well-defined object. It has 100 and something MeV. And that's an interesting universal object. The expectation value of the order parameter is not universal. For example, it suffers wave function renormalization. So you and I can define the expectation value of the order parameter differently. And therefore, when people do lattice simulations, different groups can end up with different values for psi bar psi, but they should better end up with the same value of f pi, because this is a physical quantity. Not true for supersymmetry. This is the first time we see supersymmetry is different. This is the first time I see David disturbed. And so far everything was trivial, but now, how can it be any different? Our starting point was this equation, this Ferraro-Zumino multiplet. And X plays a dual role. Its theta square component is the trace of the energy momentum tensor. This is the order parameter for supersymmetry breaking. And its theta component is the Goldstino at long distance. So we see that this is the analog of f pi, and this is the analog of the expectation value of psi bar psi. So we see that the order parameter has a natural normalization in supersymmetry, unlike chiral dynamics. So when we talk about chiral dynamics, the order parameter is one thing, f pi is something else, coming with the current. But in supersymmetry, the current and the order parameter are tied together by the supersymmetry algebra. And therefore, this object X has a well-defined normalization. This is a very preferred, there's a very preferred, well-defined order parameter in the theory. This is different than chiral dynamics. And if I have time later, I'll show you how one can use that to extract exact information in a supersymmetric theory in which supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. I have given talks in this institute about exact results in supersymmetry when supersymmetry is unbroken. And my belief at the time was that once supersymmetry is broken, all this is out the window. But in fact, there are a small number of things that can still be calculated exactly when supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. And it stems from this fact that the order parameter has a well-defined normalization.
Question. Everything looks linear up to this point, and then suddenly you have f and f squared in the same equation. Is it obvious why?
I'll soon, this will be the next six transparencies. At some point you will regret the fact that you asked this question. So here we see something interesting. This x is linear in psi, and which this will be crucial for us. The way to think about this equation, just to make you, you should really divide this equation by f. If you divide this thing by f, this is linear in psi and this is linear in f. And this is how it will appear later. So, because this is also kind of quadratic, it's f times psi. This f is a number, f is not a field. So as I said, x has a well-defined normalization, both in the UV and in the IR. And this is usually the sign that we can start extracting information. We have something that we know how to normalize at short distance, and we know how to normalize at long distance. So it allows, we can track. We don't know what's going on in between. The theory could go phase go through different phases, and God knows what. But we know how to normalize it here and here, and that's good.
This new feature is because the supersymmetry current is in the same multiple of the energy
connected. That's correct. That's correct. And this is unlike what's going on. It's completely trivial, and I don't understand why nobody mentioned that in the 70s. But I think it's true. So we continue discussing this object. And now, so you see why this X is interesting. Its theta component is an interpolating field for the Golestino. And its theta square component is the order parameter for supersymmetry breaking. And as I emphasized, it has a well-defined normalization. So we would like to write the Lagrangian for x, right? If x is an operator, we can think of it as field at long distance. And let's try and write the Lagrangian for x, which captures all the interactions of Golestinos. But we immediately face two difficulties. One of them, x has the wrong dimension. X has dimension 3 at short distance. As an operator, it has dimension 1 at long distance, but it's not normalized as a dimension 1. That's not that serious. This is trivial to fix. This problem is much more interesting. X has a fermion in its theta component. That's fine. That's the Golestino. But in addition, it has a massless scalar. So, but at long distance, we don't want the scalar. This is reminiscent of what happens in pion dynamics. In pions, we can try and take a 2x2 matrix M and write a kinetic Lagrangian for M. That realizes the symmetry correctly. However, it has one more particle, the sigma particle. How do we remove the sigma particle? The universal way to, so we can write a potential, but then it depends on short distance physics. There is a universal way of killing this. We impose a constraint. We say that this 2x2 matrix M is not any matrix, it's a unitary matrix. So our goal now is to find a good constraint on this X, which will kill the scalar. So first of all, let's deal with the first problem, the dimension. We'll just define x with subscript nl by pulling in f. I've already said that in response to Joe's question. And now we look for a constraint that this x nl satisfies, and nl stands for nonlinear. So this xnl is a chiral superfield living in ordinary superspace, but it satisfies a constraint analogous to u dagger u equals 1. So here I wrote it. So we want to eliminate the first component, the bottom component of this x nonlinear. It should be supersymmetric constraint. So we look for the analog of this equation for pions. What's the analog of u dagger u equals 1, which kills the first component of x? And it takes exactly 5 minutes of thought to come up with this equation. So we impose the equation that x nonlinear square is 0. That's a good equation to impose because it respects chirality. It's a good equation in superspace. And I claim that from this moment on, we don't need any new idea. We'll just follow our nose and we'll reproduce all the results of supersymmetry breaking. Oh, cool vocal. So let's do that. This constraint, we just solve it. So naively, the bottom component is 0 because it squares to 0. But there's a more interesting solution of this constraint, which is the following. Put any F here in the theta square, put any fermion here in the theta component, and then this equation is satisfied provided the bottom component is psi psi over F. This also smells right. The charge doesn't exist. But if the charge had existed, then what would be the super partner of a one Goldsteiner state? It can't be a scalar because we say the scalar is massive. So the super partner of the one Goldsteiner state is a two Goldsteiner state. Here it is. So the bottom component of the superfield is psi square.
Sigma is a pi pi.
Like, just like sigma is really pi, it's actually more. I think it's 3. 3 or 2? 2. Okay. But they are high order corrections and so forth. And here they are also high order corrections. It starts as psi psi, but this F is still a field. And I'll soon show you how we get rid of this F. So this part of the story is completely equivalent to what we do for pions, with one exception, that we know how to normalize this X at short distance, where for pions we don't know how to normalize U at short distance. So U is normalized to be 1, but we pull out this. Yeah. So we have the set of fields now is a fermion here and an auxiliary field F, which are arbitrary. And now we can solve the equation. So we can either use the solution or use this constraint, which is a lot easier. This is the unique solution. Sorry?
It's the only solution.
This is the only solution. This is the most general solution. And in fact, as I'll soon show, that you could also say, imagine we didn't think of the constraint. We just put any function here of psi and f. What do we know if this should be a function of just psi and f, but independent of a scalar? What is the only thing which is consistent with supersymmetry? This is the unique solution. There's an additive constant which we can easily remove, to be more precise. Okay, here I say that. This expression is uniquely follows from supersymmetry and the transformation laws of the Goldsteiners. Okay, so what have we done so far? I haven't pulled out of thin air any transformation laws. I just say consider a chiral superfield satisfying this equation or equivalently use this solution. And other Goldsteiner superfields were studied by various people, and their formalism differs from this one in many ways. One way, the closest is the formalism of Rochek. He didn't have the auxiliary field. So he had many more equations. The whole thing was much more complicated. Well, we know that in supersymmetry, if you only keep the auxiliary field in, things become a lot simpler. And all the complexity and the nonlinearity arises when we integrate out the auxiliary field. So it's a good idea to keep the auxiliary field in and not get rid of it. So this is how we differ from Rochek, and other people here had all sorts of other things. There is a long list of people, and I did not even include all of them, who studied various nonlinear realizations in components. Superspace was not even mentioned. So this is a summary so far, and now we try to write a Lagrangian. And as I said, from this moment on, we'll just follow our nose. So we write a Lagrangian. So we write a kinetic term for x and a linear term in the superpotential. And let's first examine the Lagrangian. Is there anything else we can write down? No. Anything else you try to write down would be more x's here or more x's here, and the constraint kills that. I claim that this is the analog of the free Lagrangian for M in chiral dynamics, the kinetic term for a 2x2 matrix M, which is not necessarily unitary. This is the Lagrangian. All the nonlinearities of the pion physics come from using the constraint. Kind of, we have just a kinetic term for. Indeed, this is the simplest model that breaks supersymmetry. It's a free theory, very much like the kinetic term for M. And all the nonlinearities in the theory come from the constraint, very much like in pions. So this is what I say here. If we ignore the constraint, this is the simplest model. But
there's a difference in that there's nothing you can add to this.
But you can add higher derivative terms, which we'll soon add.
Oh, I can still put derivative, ordinary derivative.
Or covariant derivatives. I'll soon consider corrections to this.
What about the logarithm of x?
The logarithm of x is very singular. It's a log of something which is Grassmann. You want the whole thing to be analytic in x. Anyway, you write this thing. It's a free theory. If you ask what's the simplest theory that you know that breaks supersymmetry, this is it. And now all we say, well, we throw in a constraint. Once we throw in a constraint, we'll see what we get. So what do? We take the solution of the constraint and we plug it in the Lagrangian. So this was the scalar. So we had a kinetic term for the scalar. So instead of the scalar, we just write psi over f. This is the kinetic term for the fermion, the quadratic term for the auxiliary field, and this comes from the superpotential terms linear in the auxiliary field. So this is all there is. It's really a free theory in disguise. Free theory that the scalar was substituted, but it is nonlinear because f is complicated. But f is an auxiliary field, so we solve its equation of motion. Its equation of motion can be solved. It starts as little f plus higher order terms with derivatives, plus higher order terms with fermions and derivatives. The expansion here stops. You plug it back in here and pops out the Akula-Volkov Lagrangian. So if you are in a deserted island and you want to know what the Volkov-Akula-Volkov Lagrangian, this is a good, much easier starting point because you don't need to invent the nonlinear transformations. You just write the free Lagrangian, remember the constraint x squared equals 0, solve the equation of motion for f. This is just algebra. And in fact, even this algebra is a lot shorter than verifying that the Akula-Volkov Lagrangian is supersymmetric. This formalism, it might be some algebra to find the actual terms, but supersymmetry is manifest in this formalism. Very much like in pion dynamics, SU2 cross SU2 is a manifest symmetry.
Derivatives of f from the first term?
We do if we do it this way, but if we start expanding around the solution, you can see that there's a unique solution for the equation of motion for f, using the fermions and so forth. Because you expand around the constant. So you expand around the constant, and then there are corrections here, which are psi dagger, psi d psi, etc.
But it terminates because you get...
Because of Fermi statistics, right. It terminates because of Fermi. I think there are 3 or 4 terms here. I don't remember. We gave them in the paper and all the coefficients, and it agrees with what Volkov and Akula would get. But the starting point here appears to be different. So here, supersymmetry is really built into the formalism because everything is done in superspace and so forth. So here is an example how this comes about. So when I give talks about supersymmetry breaking, I usually start with example number 1, which is the free theory. The free theory. So now we took the free theory and we added the constraint. So now let's take a model which has a scalar but can be integrated out. So this is the analog of the sigma model with the sigma field. And let's see how the sigma field is eliminated. So this is a particular short distance theory, which when I give talks about supersymmetry breaking, this is usually example number 2. So what do? We take a superpotential linear in a chiral superfield phi, no constraint. And the Cayley potential starts with a kinetic term, canonical kinetic term, phi dagger phi. And we add a correction to the Cayley potential. With the correction to the Cayley potential, supersymmetry is broken, but the scalar in the multiplet gets a mass, which is the scale of supersymmetry breaking, F divided by M. This is the mass of the scalar. So we have a scalar which is massive. We can integrate it out. When we integrate it out, its equation of motion says that naively phi is 0 because the potential looks like that. But in fact, the boson is a fermion bilinear. So it's really psi over f, exactly the expression that we found before. So if we substitute this scalar field in the superfield, we find this object, which is exactly our nonlinear superfield. So a nonlinear superfield pops out even if you don't like the way I introduced it. In this particular example, this is a particular microscopic example where we solve for the analog of sigma, and we'll express it in terms of the pions, and that's what we get. So that's what I say. Here, we substitute the solution back in. Now, this term in the Kähler potential drops out because it's high order term. We find just the quadratic Lagrangian, and we notice that the physics at low energies is universal. It's independent of this big M. It's independent of little m. It depends only on the scale of supersymmetry breaking, which is F. Again, by analogy to pions, at short distance things depend only on F pi and not on various properties of the potential which eliminates sigma. So that's a good sign. So we again derived this thing in a microscope from a microscopic Lagrangian. So now we come to the question of corrections. How do we start think about corrections, and then we write them down? In the case of pions, we expand in derivatives. The pion should be thought of as a dimensionless field. So the correct thing to think about is not the pion field, which has dimension 1, but the pion field divided by f pi, which is dimensionless. The reason is that the pion field is associated with the transformations of SU2 cross SU2, and the parameter of the transformation has dimension 0, right? It's transformation of a symmetry. So that's what we have for pions. The analogous thing here is that we have to assign a certain weight to the Goldstino, and the natural weight is not 3/2, but instead it's minus 1/2, because we have to divide by f. So the natural object is the Goldstino divided by f, which has dimension 2. Equivalently, the transformation that we are talking about are shifts of theta. Theta has dimension minus 1/2, so we should really think of the fermion as having weight minus 1/2. Or in terms of the superfield, we should assign this x nonlinear weight minus 1. So with this weight minus 1, things really make sense. So this is unlike pions, where we don't just expand in derivatives, but we expand in the number of derivatives minus twice the number of fermions. That's the proper expansion. And now things make sense. We just have to classify things according to this weight. So all the leading order terms we studied so far have weight 0, and these are the only fields which have weight 0. These are the only terms you can write down which have weight 0. This is the analog of the pion Lagrangian, where the leading order term has weight 2, only 2 derivatives, and u is dimensionless, and we don't assign dimension to f pi. So indeed, the leading order terms led to 2 fermions plus 1 derivative, or 4 fermions with 2 derivatives, or 8 fermions with 4 derivatives. And then it stops. All these terms are equally important. They might not be important for a scattering amplitude, say 2 going to 2 at low momentum, because then we're also expanding the number of momentum. But if we want supersymmetry to be realized properly, we need all of these terms. They all mix together. Just as with pions, we need the full exponential of the pion in order to realize the symmetry correctly. But there are corrections. So here is an example of a correction term. This, to answer your question, it's non-zero. It is a correction. It has higher weight. And it, when people ask other corrections, here is an example. Is it supersymmetric? Well, in the other formalism, it's a lot of work to check that such a term is supersymmetric, because we have all the nonlinear realization and this and that. Here, one thing is obvious. This is supersymmetric. Now, if you write it in terms of the auxiliary field, you start eliminating the auxiliary field, there might be some algebra, but there's nothing conceptual about it. You just solve the equation of motion, you plug it back in, and you find the whole bunch of terms. To make it more intuitive, if again you study only, say, 2-to-2 scattering, for fixed number of external fermions, there is a good expansion in the number of derivatives. So for fixed scattering amplitudes, say 2 going to 4 fermions, there is a good expansion in the number of derivatives. But if you want supersymmetry to work properly, you have to mix terms with different number of derivatives and different number of fermions, because you assign weight both to the fermions and to the derivatives.
So this is weight 1?
This is weight 2. 2, because there are 2 derivatives. X has minus 1, the d4 theta has 2. Huh? I can work it out in components. Now, the leading order Lagrangian has an accidental R symmetry. This is the property of the Akulo-Volkov Lagrangian. But there are correction terms you can write down which explicitly break the R symmetry. This is not surprising. There are microscopic theories which break supersymmetry and don't have an R symmetry. And therefore, we should be able to write an operator in the Goldstein-Lagrangian which explicitly breaks the symmetry. And there is an easy way to find the leading order term. It's actually very high order. This is surprising. But it's completely clear why people missed it before, because when you work in components, you get tired. And when you work like this, you easily write it down. I forget what it is. I forget the number. The operator, both in components and in superspace, is written in our paper. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say about just scattering many Goldsteinos. Now we want to couple Goldsteinos to superfields. So we have in mind some model that breaks supersymmetry, say the TV range. The scalar partner of the Goldsteino gets a mass, so we forget about it.
Is there a geometrical superspace?
I believe that... Well, there is a way with the nonlinear realizations where you talk about super Poincaré divided by Poincaré. That's what leads to the nonlinear realization. The main disadvantage of this way of thinking about it is that you don't have the auxiliary field. So the reason this formalism is so complicated is that you don't have the auxiliary field. Here, the supersymmetry variation of psi is F. If you just copy from the first chapter or whatever chapter, the beginning of Wess and Wagner, because this is just a genuine fermion in a chiral superfield. The nonlinearities come from the constraint and from solving F. In the other approach, the variation of the fermion is very complicated. In addition to that, for ordinary symmetries, I can think of this target space, which is a sphere. I can visualize it. When you have super Poincaré divided by Poincaré with all these odd dimensions, I know my imagination is reaching its end. But here, yeah, this is completely mechanical. Now, many people asked, and you will soon see more constrained superfields, whether there is a more geometric way of understanding the constraint. Well, but we have extra fields. So we work in a bigger space, which have a constraint. But it's clearly, you will see as we continue, that this is clearly the right way to think about it. Having said that, I'm sure that we're not, the words we attach to these equations can be improved. But x squared, you won't get much simpler than x squared equals zero. That's a... Okay, so now we have in mind supersymmetry broken, let's say 10 TeV, 100 TeV, whatever. Everything, all that remains for me is a Goldsteino and the MSSM. So we take the MSSM Lagrangian with its soft terms, and we try to couple the Goldsteino to it. How do we couple Goldsteinos here? So that's what we say. We consider an effective Lagrangian above the mass of the superpartners, but well below root F, like the MSSM. So I'll use the language of the MSSM, but this is clearly much more general. So the Lagrangian is made supersymmetric simply by replacing wherever you see the spurion, plug in this X nonlinear, and the Lagrangian is supersymmetric. So you write the Lagrangian with explicit term, supersymmetry breaking. You use a spurion, and then wherever you see a spurion, drop it and replace it with this guy, and now the Lagrangian is completely supersymmetric. And but you know, we still have a lot of nonlinear interactions, again coming from integrating out the auxiliary field. So here we don't even need to do any new calculation. We just take whatever people did and replace X by the spurion. And when I said that people used X, the notation X, the spurion is often denoted by X. So that's why I prefer it. And it's really an interesting coincidence that the right-hand side of the Ferraro-Zumino multiplet is denoted by X, and the spurion is denoted by X. And now I'm telling you that it's a good coincidence because they're really the same object. So the Goldsteino couplings are completely determined by the terms in the Lagrangian, including the soft terms, and one more parameter, F. So at that level, everything is what we would call universal. They depend only on what we have in the Lagrangian and F. And there are higher order corrections with more derivatives. There are higher order corrections to the MSSM, various high dimension operators which represent shorter distance physics. There are higher order corrections to the Goldstino, which we discussed before, and there could be various high order terms which represent short distance physics, and they're not universal. So they're universal terms and not universal. So notice the three different roles that X plays. X started its life as the right-hand side of the Ferrara-Zumino multiply. This is a short-distance X. And it appears as the Goldstino superfield at long distance. And it's also the spurion that people have used before. So the same X plays three different roles. And the power of this method is that we can freely go from one to the other and get mileage. So now we would like to go to lower energies. So we are done with the MSSM. And now we are really low energy people studying just the standard model. We have just the standard model and a Goldstino. And we would like to ask, how do Goldstinos couple to quarks or electrons? Scattering amplitude of, say, E plus E minus going to two Goldstinos. Or another process, Z decays to two Goldstinos. Is it universal or not? So one approach was to work with this MSSM, Lagrangian that I had before, and integrate out all the superpartners. So we have fermions, gauginos, integrate them all out. That's what people did. And when they did that, it was an incredible mess, because these calculations exhibit miraculous cancellations. And, you know, when there are miraculous calculations in the correct calculation, miraculous cancellation in the correct calculation, it's not surprising that the first time people did it, they messed up one factor of two and things didn't cancel and they got wrong answers, which could not be supersymmetrized. And there was a long, every one of these terms caused a long debate in the literature. And when we did it, it has not yet converged. So now I'm telling you how to think about it and why these miraculous cancellations are there and how to do computations without being confused by these miraculous cancellations. So we will look for a formalism to do it, which makes all these cancellations manifest. But given the introduction I've given so far, everything I said so far, it's very natural what it is we should do. So imagine we want to describe a quark. So it started its life as a quark superfield, Q, as a chiral superfield, Q. But now we would like to kill this quark. So approach number one, write the MSSM Lagrangian with this quark and integrate it out. There are many diagrams from the S channel and the T channel, and the coefficients are miraculously such that things cancel at low momentum. Moreover, there's another approach which is very natural from our point of view. We don't want this quark. So we shouldn't have this quark in the first place. It's not that we should introduce it and then kill it by its equation of motion. We should kill it from the start. And the way to kill this quark is to impose a constraint. So we replace Q, which is an arbitrary chiral superfield, with a nonlinear Q, which is a constrained superfield, and we impose this equation. So we've already had X at our disposal. We impose that X times Q vanishes. This kills this quark. More precisely, it tells us that where the lowest component of Q of this superfield, which is roughly the superpartner of the quark, is not a quark because this quark is not there. Instead, it's a two-particle state. It's a quark and a Goldstino. Because what does it mean to be the superpartner of the quark? It's a two-particle state, a quark and a Goldstino. And this is what this equation is telling us. So now it's completely obvious what needs to be done. We take this nonlinear superfield Q, this nonlinear superfield X, and we write a Lagrangian. And you write your favorite Lagrangian in superspace using Q and X. There are tons of terms you can write down. Impose the constraint. They kill most of the terms. And from this point on, you don't need to do anything. That's the Lagrangian. Now, if you want to write the explicit couplings, you need to integrate things out using their equation of motion, the auxiliary fields using their equation of motion, and you find the couplings. So there are three kinds of couplings. There are couplings which are universal. They depend only on the kinetic term of the quarks, say, and F. So these are completely universal, very much like the universal coupling in pion nucleon scattering. Then there are terms which are not universal. They arise from terms with the same weight, but their coefficient is arbitrary in this Lagrangian. They are similar to GA in pion physics. And then there are various terms which are higher derivatives, which are even worse. So as I say here, there are terms that we could get from, it depends only on F, terms that if we start from the MSSM, they come there, and then there are various other terms, and things become complicated. But this is where we get one of the bonuses. The miraculous cancellations are completely obvious in this formalism, because various terms that people try to write down are simply zero by the constraint. So the constraint simply tells us, you know, this term is not there, and it's, we don't need to compute anything to see that it miraculously cancels. So this is really easy. Now we move to gauge fields, and by that time, it's quite obvious what we need to do. We just have to guess the right constraints or derive the right constraints. There are really two issues with gauge fields. One is gauge invariance, and the other is the gauge genus. In supersymmetry, gauge fields have a larger gauge symmetry than in non-supersymmetric theories. Usually this is fixed by picking Wezumino gauge. But Wezumino gauge is not supersymmetric. So we need to find the supersymmetric version of Wezumino gauge to restrict only to the gauge symmetry that we need to preserve. And that takes exactly 1 minute of thought, and this is it. So this is Wezumino gauge. It's manifestly supersymmetric. I just write an equation in superfields, and it does the right thing. It kills the remaining gauge freedom. The remaining gauge freedom has gauge symmetries, chiral superfield in supersymmetry, and the remaining, which is preserved by that, is x times this chiral superfield is zero. So that's Wezumino. We also need to get rid of the gauge genus. This equation gets rid of the gauge genus. I will not do all the details. By this part of the talk, this will take you 2 seconds to guess these things and then check that they are indeed correct. And again, we write a Lagrangian, and it has universal terms that depend only on F. There are terms that if we started from the MSSM, depend only on the soft terms. And there are various high order terms which are not universal at all, and we know nothing about them, but they could be there. And finally, we can repeat this thing for scalars. So for scalars, we can start again with a chiral superfield, H, say a Higgs field. So imagine you want to have the Higgs field, and imagine the Higgsinos are much heavier than the Higgs. So we need to get rid of the Higgsino. This constraint does the job. And if we have Goldstone bosons, for example, an R axion, which is very popular in supersymmetric theories, if you wish a real scalar, this is the constraint. Roughly speaking, A minus A, roughly speaking, the object that you're trying to set to zero, or you're trying to eliminate, you can't write it zero because this would be too strong. So what you do is you multiply it by X nonlinear, and that's soft enough because it only says that the Grassmann nature is what kills it. Now, as typical with constraints, the constraints are easy to write down. The solution of the constraint is complicated. But for most applications, you don't need to solve the constraint. You just work with the constraint field, and you remember that there is this constraint. This thing actually, well, you can again write a Lagrangian and do the same thing. And there are all these terms. This particular thing has led Komogorsky, Dine, and postdoctor whose name I forget, and to have a beautiful paper where they use this formalism to derive a bound on the value of the superpotential in supersymmetric theories. And the only way one could do that is actually use this formalism. So if you have a theory which is supersymmetric and has an R symmetry, the value of the superpotential is a meaningful object. You cannot add a constant to it. So what they showed is that the superpotential expectation value, absolute value, is less than or equal than twice what I call F here, times the axion decay constant. And this is true with weakly coupled theories, strongly coupled theories, and it basically follows from this formalism. You write the low energy Lagrangian and this thing pops out. And you have the inequality arises from a constraint on positivity of higher derivative terms in the Lagrangian that follows from unitarity and causality. So that's what gives an inequality. So here is a pure result which comes from this formalism. So let me summarize. Suzy breaking is characterized by a very natural order parameter, unlike ordinary symmetry breaking. And this is this chiral superfield X. So this X includes the order parameter for supersymmetry breaking, and therefore it is the interpolating field for the Goldstino. And unlike chiral dynamics, it is in the same multiplet as the energy momentum tensor and supersymmetry current. So I've said that. So with low energies, X still exists, and that's a natural object to use as the Goldstino field. But in order to kill a scalar, we impose a nonlinear constraint, which is really easy. It's X squared equals zero. And now it's completely straightforward to write the Lagrangian, control the corrections, understand which corrections are supersymmetric and which are not. So the leading order Lagrangian is universal. It depends only on F, a decay constant, very much like pi, but the corrections are not. The corrections are more complicated. The coupling to superfields is, again, straightforward. We simply identify this X nonlinear with the spurion of the MSSM. So wherever you see the spurion, you plug this X. Couplings below the mass of the superpartners are again found using constrained superfields. So the constrained superfields are the following. If we want fermions from chiral superfields, we impose this constraint again. We want to kill the lowest, the bottom component of Q. So we can't say Q equals zero, but we can say X times Q equals zero, and that kills the bottom component. For vector fields, we had to deal with gauge invariance and the gaugino. For complex fields, we impose this. For real scalars, we impose that. The details are not important. What I do want to emphasize is simple constraints eliminate all the mess in this subject. And alternative formalisms exhibit miraculous cancellations. Now, I've already said that some terms are universal, depend only on F. Other terms depend on F and the soft terms in the MSSM. And there are high-order corrections, which are much more complicated. I've said that more times than you wanted to hear. And this formalism has allowed us to rederive, clarify, and significantly extend the entire literature on the subject, which is hundreds of papers, which are really easily captured by these equations. So the next step is obvious. There are many potential phenomenological consequences which we have not yet analyzed. I think the odds that this thing is measurable, the odds are small, but it's still interesting to try and see if there is an interesting process. In particle physics, people have used such couplings to constrain F. The bounds are not too exciting. It's a worthwhile exercise to do, and it gives bounds which are not that exciting. LHC should give us stronger bounds because we raise the energy, but again, it will not be too exciting. However, there are other potential applications, not in particle physics, and that's in astrophysics and cosmology. If we have light gravitinos, they affect cosmology, they affect cooling of red giants or supernova, and that has not been done. We know what the couplings are, so now we should, in principle, be able to do that. So this is in progress. I'll stop here. Thank you.
I'm asking the same question I asked you the first time.
This is the third time you hear this talk. By now you should know all the answers.
The invisible width of the Z decay to two Goldstinos. Is that universal or is that?
Interesting. It's almost universal. It's almost universal. It depends only on the expectation value of the D term of that U1 in the MSSM. So in that sense, it's almost universal. It comes from the kinetic term of the Higgs field. So that's why it's trying to be universal. But this is where it comes from. This is actually a particular term which caused a lot of confusion in the literature. Because people wrote the term, and then people said that this term is really absent. And in fact, we asked one of the co-authors of the paper, which ended up being correct, but was criticized. So we asked him, is your paper correct or not? What about the criticism? And he said, it's still unclear. So this is an example of a term that can be easily computed. So we worked it out also in our paper, you know, using our formalism.
If the level is nonlinear Lagrangian, is there any difference between F-term and D-term breaking?
And very interesting question. D-term breaking is something that one should, the quick answer is D-term breaking is something that one should not be thinking about. And let me give you a two-line explanation. This X, which is the starting point, is a chiral superfield, and it looks like F-term breaking. Now, even if there is a D-term, like you take the Fayet-Leopoulos model, and there is a D-term breaking, and depending on the parameters, there are two phases. A phase where it's only D-term, and another phase where it's both D and F. So no matter how large the D-term is, it can be arbitrarily larger than the F-term, this formalism is still perfect. In the other phase, where the breaking is purely D-term, and the reason is basically that if we have both D-terms and F-terms, we can always redefine away the D-term by subtracting from the D-term F dagger F with the appropriate coefficient. So D-term breaking is when there is any field with an F-term can always be removed. So your question is really, what happens when it's pure D-term? So we asked ourselves precisely this question in the context of doing that, and then we realized, to our great surprise, that in this case, X exists, just like here, but it's not gauge invariant. So this object X, which was so crucial for this discussion, is not gauge invariant in this case. So that's why we wrote a separate paper talking about D terms. This whole multiplet J is no longer gauge invariant. So J is not gauge invariant, X is not gauge invariant, and in components, in plain English, the energy momentum tensor and the supersymmetry current are not gauge invariant. And there's a beautiful paper by Polchinski and others showing that the Fayet-Leopoulos term is not renormalized. From this perspective, so this result has many other proofs using holomorphy and so forth, but now I'm giving a new perspective on this result. If you start at short distance without an FI term, then J and X are gauge invariant. So at that point, they're going to remain gauge invariant. Nothing is going to ruin that. And that's why you are not going to generate non-zero FI term. So that's one thing. Also, if the current is not gauge invariant, you shouldn't be surprised. You can live with that. But it's painful, but you can live with that. But it's really deadly when you try to gauge the symmetry. So all the confusion with FI terms in gravity stem from this fact. So I offered you two seminars, choose one of between the two. So now I managed to give the second one. Mark?
The word gravitino suddenly appeared.
Yes, and gravitino is the same. Light gravitino, is, for all practical purposes, is a Goldstino.
Well, suppose I start cranking up F, and the gravitino mass starts coming up. When do I have to worry?
You have to start worrying with the gravitational coupling. See the transverse gravitino, so to speak, the spin 3 half component of it, the third component of isospin 3 half, couples only with gravitational strength. The third component of isospin being a half, minus a half, couples with strength roughly F. So as you crank up the energy, F, at some F becomes closer to M Planck, and then you have to start worrying about it. But as long as the...
Well, but is it M Planck, or is it, you know, root M Planck, low energy?
No, the couplings are F. F, and for the trans, what you can call the transverse one, the spin 3 half, it's only M Planck. And for the other, it's F. Example, for W bosons, there is what is called the equivalence theorem. The equivalence theorem tells you that when you do, say, E plus, E minus to W's, it essentially goes to the mode which is eaten. And this is the correct thing when G is small. When G is getting larger, you also couple to the other components of W. This is identical. So here I was mostly interested in low-scale breaking, where the gravitino is much lighter than the MSSM particle, than the superpartner. In fact, it's even much lighter than the standard model particles. Right? It's a few EVs or a few KEVs. So that's clearly okay. Now, things become a little bit more confusing when it is a TV-ish. The gravitino is TV-ish.
Yeah, that's
real. That's when it gets mixed with all the superpartners in the MSSM. But what I said, most of what I said still goes through. Now, another question which typically comes up when I give this talk is, what about coupling this whole thing to supergravity? And this is an obvious thing to do. We haven't thought about it. I think this is something that is relatively straightforward to do. And I think then, if I've done this exercise, I could have given you a much more complete answer. This thing begs, okay, this formalism really begs to be stated differently. It's not that we pull this constraint, but this constraint must describe something which has a better meaning than just, look, it works. And similarly, I think it really begs to be coupled to supergravity, and there might be something interesting there.
In supergravity, especially in higher dimensions, people talk about constraints also. I mean, is there any connection between those?
Not as far as I can tell, but there it's a situation where supersymmetry is unbroken. Here we use the constraint to kill degrees of freedom, which are not there because supersymmetry is broken, but we still use the supersymmetric formalism to describe them. Right? We kind of have supersymmetry even though it's broken. And that's what, yeah. So I don't see an immediate connection, but you know, I might be proven wrong about that.
One last question. Given F and the gravitational constant, is that enough to determine the gravitational mass?
Yeah. The gravitational mass is F divided by M Planck. And there are some 2s and pi's here, which I don't remember, which also depend on how you define M Planck.
There's something I thought very quickly, and maybe you don't want to repeat it, but the derivation of the nonlinear one from the linear model, was it transparent? I mean,
yeah. I'll do it on the blackboard, because this is really the key thing, because it's good to have one example where you can really hold on to. So we have an angle d4 theta. This is big phi. To the fourth, and there's a linear superpotential. So let's write this thing in components. And since we are at low energy, we can drop all derivatives. So what can we get from here without derivatives? So from here we get only F squared. And here, let's see if I can do it right. We can get F squared phi squared. And they are, I'm in trouble. We get psi F. Yeah, I think I'll be able to do it. F dagger phi. And psi dagger F phi, this has a dagger. And I think this is all there is. Okay, and there is psi to the fourth. Okay, now we want to integrate out phi. So you see that the solution of the equation of motion for phi is phi equals psi psi over f. Just from here, the equation of motion for phi. Is that clear? Or
yeah.
Should I add more steps or?
No. I was trying to get this direct superfield derivation in some
sense. Well, it cannot be because we try to integrate out the scalar.
Yes, right.
Keeping the fermion in F. Mm-hmm. So we saw that.
So there's not a simple relation between phi and x. X or phi is x.
The little x.
The x.
It is. Yeah. It is the same thing.
Yeah. Just after solving the equation.
Yep.
Okay.
Up to factors of little f, yeah. There's something here which is, in some deep sense, confusing, and I don't know how to resolve the confusion. All these constraints and all that look like nice and holomorphic. X squared equals zero. There's no statement about x dagger equals zero. So it smells like it should come from an f term. But it doesn't. It comes actually here from a D term. And I don't know whether I should be... Well, it's clearly right. You know, you solve for phi. It's clearly right. But. So let me give you an example where all these things work. You know the Urofsky model. So if you look at the Urofsky model at tree level, you find what I call example number one. So there's one chiral superfield, massless, with a flat potential and the scalar is massless. If you include one-loop corrections in the Urofsky model, the potential gets a mass. And then the low-energy effective Lagrangian is essentially this one for that chiral superfield, because the mass is much lower than... And we have this M here. Now, the same thing that happens here happens also in the Urofsky model. See that the solution for phi is independent of the overall factor M that appears out front. The solution is psi psi over F, independent of the high energy scale. So when you substitute it back in here, all memory of M is gone. And the low energy theory depends only on F. Very much like with the sigma model. You know, you can crank the mass of the sigma field up or down. It has no effect whatsoever on the pion Lagrangian. At leading order, high order corrections, of course, depend on it. But the pion Lagrangian depends only on f pi. And this exercise is the analog of integrating out sigma in the leading order.
Okay. Thank you.